Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week we talk about science writing. Anthropologist and author Sarah Parkek discusses her book Archaeology from Space, How the Future Shapes Our Past, with Adler Planetarium astronomer and artist Lucianne Walkowicz. This conversation originally took place August 13th, 2019, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks for being here tonight. My name's Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director here at the American Writers Museum. We're here tonight to welcome Sarah Parkek and Lucianne Walkowicz to talk about Sarah's book, Archaeology from Space, How the Future Shapes Our Past. The story of the extraordinary new world of space archaeology is the story of how we see ourselves. Through spy photographs and satellite imagery, we can look thousands of years into our own history and discover what would otherwise be completely invisible to us. Sarah has worked on five continents and over 20 years of experience in the anthropology field, including as a National Geographic explorer. Her work has been the subject of three BBC specials about ancient Egypt, Rome, and the Vikings, and she was a 2014 Senior TED Fellow and winner of the 2016 TED Prize. She's joined by Lucianne, an astronomer at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago. She studies stellar magnetic activity and how stars influence a planet's suitability as a host for alien life. She's also an artist and works in a variety of media from oil paint to sound. Welcome to both of you.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for coming. So Sarah and I have known each other for several years, so it was like a really wonderful surprise. We were like, will you talk to this like space archaeologist person? I was like, how long do you have? I guess we had talked a little bit backstage, and I kind of wanted to kick off just by talking about, first of all, congratulate Sarah on her book, please. Has anyone here read it so far? I see at least one copy tucked into the thing. All right. I have partially read it in the interest of full disclosure. But I wanted to hear a little bit about like how the book came around because, you know, being here in the American Writers Museum, I thought it would be fun to talk not only about space and archaeology, but also just about writing.
So yeah, so it all started in 2016, shortly after I won the TED Prize, and my TV agent had been poking me for a while and saying, you know, you should really write a book. And I know authors, and I said, yeah, I know better than to write a book. Where am I going to find the time? I've got, you know, a young child. I'm trying to kick off this big platform. He said, you really need to think about writing a book. It's time. And I think I'd written an academic book, and to me that seemed much easier than writing a book for the general public. I can give an hour talk, I can give lectures. The idea of writing something that was in the range of 80,000 words that people would actually want to keep reading. I joke that if you are having trouble sleeping at night, you should buy my textbook and read the first two pages of the third chapter. And if you're not asleep, you must be a remote sensing specialist. So I think in the process of thinking about the proposal and thinking through all the books that were out there for the general public about archaeology, first of all, there really aren't popular books about archaeology by women. And I think in academia right now we're having a bit of a moment for women, for people of color, the idea of making the field more diverse, making space for other people, and to me that's incredibly important. So the idea that I could write something and show people not only can you do it, but it's necessary and we need to provide these opportunities for other people, that became really important. And then, you know, we're natural storytellers. The joke in archaeology is that one stone is a stone, two stones are a feature, and three stones make a wall. If you find four stones together, you probably found a temple. So the idea that we're weaving all this evidence together from the past and sharing stories, that became really important for me to do. So that's really what drove me to write this.
It's funny that you mentioned that because I think that this is something that people don't realize about science, like physical sciences as well, that you know, like one data point is, you know, a potentially interesting discovery. Two is a line with no error bars. three is definitely a line, and like four is totally a, like a trend in the universe that you've discovered. So there's a certain element of storytelling, I think, that comes with it as well. It might be helpful, I'm not totally sure that everybody is familiar with what exactly is different about the archaeology that you do and what a space archaeologist actually is. It might be helpful to give a little quick recap of that.
Sure. So in archaeology, of course, we spend a lot of our time looking for things, and we're assisted by a lot of tools on the ground to help us see beneath the ground to figure out where walls are buried. But when we're dealing with massive landscapes, prior to aerial photography and then satellites, you know, it was really hard to figure out where things were. So the field of space archaeology is the use of different kinds of satellite sensors and air-based sensors to map and model ancient landscapes. Think of it almost like a space-based CAT scan system where you have buried features, sometimes things like pyramids, sometimes things like houses, and the stones and materials that are under the ground affect the overlaying vegetation and soils in very subtle ways that we can't see with our naked human eye. But the satellites recording the Earth record all this information in different parts of the light spectrum that we can't see, and we process it using algorithms, and all of a sudden these features pop out in the landscape, and instead of maybe being able to map or survey 10 sites or 15 sites over the course of a season, we know exactly where to go, and we can find hundreds, if not thousands, of sites very, very quickly. But in archaeology, it's not about the finding, it's about the finding out. So what we do is we ask big, it's science, so it's hypothesis-driven research. So we're asking questions about, like, how and why did civilizations rise or collapse? How or why did this city grow in importance and then all of a sudden wasn't important? And maybe it's because a river changed course and all of a sudden that city lost its main transportation route. So these are the kinds of things we can look for using satellite imagery. We know exactly where to go.
So talk to me a little bit about, like, what your actual data looks like. So this is essentially like digital photography in the same way that, you know, I think in astronomy, people often have that picture, which, you know, if you come to the Adler, you'll see like a whole bunch of telescopes, including like telescopes you can look through that look exactly like what you think they look like. But nowadays, you know, telescopes haven't, well, small telescopes still look like that, but the telescopes that professional astronomers use, you know, most of the time, like my job looks like me in front of a laptop. It's like, you know, when like, people want to come and interview me, like, are you doing anything cool today? And be like, yes, but it just looks like me in front of a laptop.
Funnily enough, me too. Hi. Yeah, it's not, well, to me, it's really exciting because, like most scientists, we spend our time in long conference calls and writing grants and writing reports. And anytime I do science, it's really exciting. But it doesn't look exciting. But in archaeology, we go from the known to the unknown. So we never, I tell people, some people seem to think I've got like a magical Harry Potter wand, and I wave it over the satellite imagery, and the ghostly outlines of a city just appear, and then it's there in 3D. And maybe that goes on in my head, but that is absolutely not how the science happens. So what we do if we're looking in a particular landscape, let's say Egypt, and we're working in an area like Saqqara, which has lots of pyramids and lots of tombs from over 2,000 years, we develop databases of all the known archaeological sites and features in that area, wherever in the world we're working. And then we start looking at the landscape and the geology. Is it sand? Is it part of the floodplain? Is it hilly? Is there any kind of elevation? What are the sizes and shapes and orientations of all the features that are there? What types are they? Pyramids, tombs, temples, settlements. And we start looking at all the pictures of everything that's there. And this is before we even order the satellite imagery. Because you've got to know what you're looking at. You have to know if there's any hints of anything beneath the ground. It's really, really easy to get things wrong. And I should say, I hope I'm pretty honest in the book about some times when I was wrong. It's good to be honest about science. Science is a long process of failure and iteration and repeating and hoping you get something right 1 out of 1,000 times if you're lucky. And so when you're processing the imagery, it's in phases. So you're doing work and you're teasing out information. You're teasing out information very slowly with different kinds of algorithms, and finally you might see the hint of an outline of a shape. And then you really focus in on that area. And when you find something that works in one part of the image,
you extrapolate and you apply it to a larger part of the image. And by the way, I should say this is a super collaborative project. I'm never working by myself. I'm always collaborating with my friends and colleagues in Egypt or in Iceland or in Scotland. And we're constantly sharing information. So it's never there's never a hero archaeologist. It's I'm always part of a team.
Give or take an Indiana Jones-esque leather jacket.
Guilty as charged, Your Honor.
So this is the part that I'm very jealous of, is that you actually get to go to the place that the thing you're looking at is and check it out, which is really like not an option in space.
Not yet.
For the most part. So I guess I'd like to know a little bit about like the process of that. You do all of this recon on the images that you have. You actually order new data, so new satellite images to be taken. At what point do you actually get to go there? Or, like, are there places that you get to go? When do you find out if you're wrong?
So usually what we do by this sort of collaborative process, and if I'm working with my team at an organization I run called Global Explorer, we'll all look at imagery, we'll all cross-check each other, and maybe we'll come up with a top 10 list of interesting things we think look like features that are known or excavated already, and we'll send those to specialists. And let's just say it's in a place like Scotland, so we send them off to specialists in the Viking period, and they'll write us back and say, features 1, 8, and 10 look amazing. I do not know what you were smoking when you were looking at 2 and 3, but it's like nothing that's there. But I think these three things are definitely worth checking out, and honestly, I'd go with 8. That looks the best to us. So we rely very heavily on the specialists of the region. Now, obviously, I'm an Egyptologist. That's a little different, but when I'm working in other parts of the world, I really do rely on other experts. And then sometimes it can be pretty quick if we're already collaborating and we know we are going to a particular place within the next month or 6 months, then we'll go. In Egypt, the permitting process is a little bit different. I've been working at the same site. It's a 3,800-year-old site called El Lisht. I've been working there since 2015. So we start our permitting process about 6 months before our season begins. I work with the very kind permission of the Egyptian government, and they have very, very strict rules and regulations around that process, and we have to tell them exactly where we're going. But I'm very lucky. I'm very fortunate. I've gotten to travel all over the world. We are wrapping up a project in Peru. We're about to go to India. So I joke with people in the middle of the winter, I definitely dream of doing remote sensing projects in Fiji. But who knows? Maybe I'll work there someday.
You will encounter no sympathy for getting away from Alabama in the winter in Chicago.
Yeah. I figured I wouldn't.
So talk a little bit about Global Explorer, right? This was the platform that you set up after the Ted Prize.
So one of the big questions we have in archaeology, first is how many archaeological sites are out there left to find? And also, how can we create sort of a more equitable world for exploration? And right now, to specialize in remote sensing, to be able to access the data, there's only maybe now 1,000, a couple hundred, I don't know exactly how many people there are that specialize in what I do. But I decided to set up Global Explorer, which is a citizen science platform that allows anyone in the world to look at satellite imagery and help find ancient sites, because there are only so many of us, and most governments around the world don't have databases of archaeological sites. You ask a biologist how many species of this particular kind of frog are there, and they'll say 387, and they'll be able to tell you where they are. If you ask any archaeologist how many archaeological sites are around the world, not a single archaeologist would be able to answer that question, which is ridiculous because archaeological sites are mostly pretty big. So the idea is that you create a platform and you allow everyone to look, and you're able to work much, much faster and more efficiently. Most of the time when I'm looking at imagery, I'm just looking and looking and looking and not finding anything. So with Global Explorer, so to date, I think we've had almost 90,000 users from 120 countries, and they've found over 20,000 potential archaeological features in Peru, and about 700 of them have been determined by experts to be major sites.
That's amazing. So this is an example of something. Have people heard the term citizen science before? Yeah, so I see some nods. If it's unfamiliar, so that's kind of the phrase for all of this
exploration of, you know, what would otherwise be technical data that is, generally speaking, historically been very inaccessible to people who don't have some kind of like technical training, whether it's in archaeology or whether it's in astronomy. So one of the things that we do at the Adler is we're part of the developers for something called Zooniverse. So this was a project that started as something called Galaxy Zoo back just about a decade or more now, where there were all these images of galaxies, these big collections of billions of stars out in space, and people were interested in exploring them, but, you know, it's a big task to take all of these images and go through and, like, tag them, label them as to what kind of galaxy they are. And so this online platform, Zooniverse, started as a way of exploring those images, much in the same way that you're describing with Global Explorer. And one of the things that I think has been really interesting about that, you know, nowadays, Zooniverse hosts, like, tons and tons of different stuff. I don't think we have archaeology specifically, but we have, like, for example, a project called Old Weather, where you look at ship logs and read that, or Snapshot Serengeti, where you look at animals and, like, count the number of penguins in this image, in addition to, like, things like, I work on a mission called Kepler, where we look for planets around other stars. And, you know, people who are not astronomers, who don't, generally speaking, have the ability to, like, write a program the way that I would if I was interacting with the data, have done things like find new planets around other stars that weren't discovered by people with professional astronomy training. And I think it's really amazing to see this exploration really democratized in that way.
Yeah, I think for archaeology for some people is hard in that, first of all, it can be expensive to get to other places. It is an incredibly ableist field. If you are not able-bodied and able to go out into the field specifically, it can be really hard. And of course, especially since having a child, like, I see we're all naturally born explorers. And the big question when we launched Global Explorer is, can we truly democratize archaeology? We just didn't want to create something, you know, just fun for kids. We wanted to create something that would work, that archaeologists could use, that would generate important data, and also allow people to do the science that I and my colleagues do. So design played a really important role in creating the platform. Before we began development, we spent about 6 months speaking to people like the people behind Zooniverse and other citizen science platforms. We spent a lot of time talking to people of all ages and backgrounds about the types of things that they wanted to see in a platform like this. And we've had users as young as 4 and 5, and we've had kids as old as in their 90s and older. So the idea that we've developed something for everyone that people feel really connected to is really important to me. And also, we've now, because we're redeveloping the platform for our India launch, which we hope will be at some point early next year, we've gotten feedback from many, many hundreds of people about things they liked and didn't like. And so we're taking all of that and incorporating it in how we're developing it and making it more a better experience for everyone.
Have there been examples in your field of people finding stuff that, you know, the so-called experts have missed?
So there was one instance, to me it's kind of one of my favorite use cases of Global Explorer. So our platform focused on an area of Peru called Nazca, which is really famous for these things. Some of you may have heard of the Nazca Line, so these massive geoglyphs that are sacred monkeys and birds and butterflies that the Nazca people carved into the landscape. And it's still kind of debated as to what their purpose was in archaeology. If we don't know what it is, we say it was for ritual purposes. so it was for ritual purposes, clearly very important and symbolic to the Nazca peoples. And so our citizen scientists found many, many dozens of new potential sites in the Nazca region, and then we shared them with my dear friend, Luis Jaime Castello, who's just been named the Minister of Culture in Peru. We're very excited about that. And so he then took the data and went out and was doing drone mapping, and he, as a side sort of result of mapping these new sites, ended up finding 50 new Nazca lines. So the idea that this data can be taken and given and help empower local archaeologists, to me, is it's just an extension of citizen archaeology. Ultimately, we're giving the people on the ground in the places that know best the tools and resources that they might not otherwise have access to.
Yeah, I think this is something that, you know, as you mentioned in the beginning, that we're kind of seeing this moment in academia, which I think is happening to some extent everywhere, a kind of leveling of the playing field, a space being made for people who have been excluded traditionally from some of these practices. And it's really been encouraging for me to see the emphasis on collaboration that exists in, I think, both of our fields, where there's this myth of the lone genius that, you know, like, if you look at like Einstein or let me pick a fictional character. So Doc Brown from Back to the Future. That's often who people picture when they picture, you know, an astronomer or a scientist, and they often picture Indiana Jones. And, you know, when they think about archaeology. And so I think it's been really gratifying to me to see the way the teamwork is becoming more part of the narrative, because that's really actually how it is. You know, even any of these like so-called famous lone geniuses that are from history had a body of colleagues that they were talking to, you know?
I often get asked, you know, what's it like in the field? Again, people think I've got a Harry Potter wand and the magic just happens. The reality is I am a combination hotel manager, CEO, diplomat, food planner, and nurse. It is my job to make sure that my team, which is composed of about 100 Egyptians and foreigners, are able to do their jobs really, really well. I run a joint mission with Egypt's Ministry of Antiquities, which means I have equal numbers of Egyptian and foreign team participants. I have an Egyptian co-director. I have a staff that I work with, probably about 60 to 70 local workmen. And to me, the workman that's filling up the bucket with sand is every bit as important as the senior professor specialist who's written 100 articles on a particular subject. Everyone plays a crucial role, and archaeologists haven't done as good of a job celebrating the local workforce, but frankly, we couldn't do it without them. And my job all day long, I tell people, I just go around, I make sure that my team has coffee and snacks. I make sure that when the ceramics team has run out of glue, I know, so that they can get glue, and then they do their jobs really well. Because at the end of the day, I'm responsible for my team's health and safety and well-being, both the Egyptian workforce and foreign workforce. And I'm responsible to the U.S. government, who has helped to fund my projects. So it's my job to keep things moving. My husband, who is also an archaeologist, he used to run projects, and now I do. And my job is also to make sure that he is happy excavating, because for years and years he had the hat that I wear now, and I appreciate it so much more. It's really, really hard work, and it's not usually fun or glamorous, but at the end of the day, you know, every now and then I get to stick my trowel in the ground and remember what it was like before I was responsible. And that's a good reminder.
Yeah, my version is sticking my program in the data myself. I get to like write a couple lines of code, and I'm like, people don't realize that Indiana Jones's hat said "Procurer of Coffee and Snacks" on the back of it.
It does now on the front.
So, you know, one of the things that I think is so interesting about this kind of movement to equalize and democratize access to this stuff is that, you know, we're often, I think, caught up in, like, the terrible things that the internet has brought into our lives. But it really is something that I think wouldn't have been possible without the internet. Because I wonder if we can talk a little bit about the history of, like, remote sensing, because it once upon a time it was film, right? Canisters of film.
That's right. So, yeah, so the whole field started over 100 years ago. So the first remote sensing of an archaeological site happened in 1908 around Stonehenge. A British lieutenant put a camera on a tethered balloon and took pictures around Stonehenge, and what he noticed was staining in the fields around the site. And archaeologists looked at that and went, wait a minute, those could be like buried features. And so over time, the field developed, of course, with World War I and people taking pictures. Archaeologists served in the nascent Royal Air Force, and they went out with their hobby cameras to take pictures of archaeological sites across the Middle East and showed them to their captains. And they went, wait a minute, you can take pictures of things from airplanes? We could use this to spy on the bad guys, or the people they said were the bad guys. And so it's ironic. Archaeology actually started the field of aerial reconnaissance in the military, and that kind of flipped around. So one of the main data sets that we use now is something called Corona high-resolution spy photography from the 1960s. This is photography that was taken between the U.S. and Russia in the Cold War. And it's important to us because it preserves landscapes that are no longer around. And so a lot of archaeologists are using that data, and of course, in addition to satellites.
Yeah, I think I mentioned this to you. I have a historical connection to Corona, and we both have familial connections that actually brought us into doing what we do. So, I often think it's ironic when people talk about like the new era of like private industry going into space, like companies like Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos's company, and SpaceX, which is Elon Musk's, and all of these other things, because the history of observations from space, which was actually like satellite reconnaissance with Corona, was private companies. So the very first satellites that were put into space to actually observe the Earth that brought back these images were in part developed by a company called iTech. My father was in the Air Force, so my father had me when he was a lot older. For anyone who's doing the math, he was 59 when I was born. So he was actually in the Air Force during the Cold War and did a lot of the intelligence work and had actually transitioned into private industry and was the only person on working in the Rockefeller's venture fund who had the security clearance to know that iTech's main contractor was the CIA developing the Corona satellites, which is like kind of how that whole thing got started. And so we have this like long history, both, and I'll mention this also comes into astronomy, of like observing the Earth from space, that very much started with military intelligence surveillance. And even today, let's see, this was maybe back in 2012 or 2013, astronomy got a call where we suddenly were told, the word made its way around, that there were two new telescopes that just had the wrong focal length that we could have from the National Reconnaissance Office if we wanted. So there are missions being planned right now, one called WFIRST, where if you retrofit something that was meant to look down at the Earth, you can use it to look out at space. That's a mission that I'll probably launch in the next several years here. But there's this longstanding overlap between satellite surveillance of Earth and our observations of space in astronomy as well.
and kind of getting back to the familial connection, so my grandfather was one of the pioneers of using aerial photography in forestry. And while we kind of take this for granted now, because we're all walking around with Google Earth in our pockets, essentially, he was in the Screaming Eagles in World War II. Of course, we've just celebrated the 75th anniversary of the jump by the paratroopers. And he got the state-of-the-art technology at the time, which was a little fold-out black and white contour map that he kept in his pocket so that when he landed over Marie-Saint-Église 75 years ago, he could unfold it and use it to read the landscape to meet up with his men. He was a captain. And he took this knowledge with him to graduate school and using this new cutting-edge technology to map trees and tree height. And I've sort of found his articles from the 1950s, thanks to the miracle of the internet. And he talks about what will we find when we can see in infrared. And it's amazing because almost word for word, I sort of must have been channeling him when I wrote some of my early academic papers, because they're very similar to each other.
So is infrared light used now in mapping in the work that you do, or is it mostly like visible light? So if you're not familiar, infrared is essentially heat vision. So it's the red, low energy part of the spectrum of light, a little bit outside of where your eyes are sensitive to. So you probably have seen heat vision and, like movies, but is it also used in remote sensing?
Yeah, near, middle, and far infrared are essential with the work that I do. So you think, if you remember, not this summer, but the summer before, there was a big drought in the UK, and there were many, many articles that came out showing all these outlines of medieval churches and Bronze Age barrows and Iron Age hill forts that just showed up in the landscape. And this is because when vegetation is growing on top of, say, a stone structure, right? Its roots are going to be stunted. It's not going to be able to go as deep. And maybe visibly, we can't see that that grass is a little bit less healthy, but in the near infrared, which is where we see chlorophyll reflected in chlorophyll as an indicator of plant health, you see it as just a little bit less healthy. And it's one thing to just see a blob, but it's another thing entirely to see an outline of an entire building. And that's what we often will see when we're processing imagery using different parts of the light spectrum. And it may not be, say, a stone wall in England. It may be a mud brick wall that's buried in the desert in Egypt. And we can see the differences as the mud brick degrades into the silty soil in, say, the middle infrared, which is really good for looking at differences in geology. In some cases, the actual heat of the archaeological site is hotter or colder than the area around it, so we'll use a satellite imagery to find those differences. And everywhere in the world is different. We use different technologies depending on what the structures were made from.
Yeah, we do the same thing in space, is that we use the full complement, all the energies of light, to be able to look out. Specifically, actually, the infrared is really important for us for studying things that are shrouded in dust, and also for looking very far back in time, because the expansion of the universe shifts all of that light that would be in the visible portion for our eyes if it was close to us far into the red, and the further back or the more faintly we could look into the universe, and also the further into the red that we can look, we end up getting to see further back in time, because it takes a while for that light to come to us. I also, just to bring it back to the Cold War for a second, I recently was reading a book about the history of Area 51, which is, you know, where a lot of like spy technology was developed, a lot of the advanced like aeronautical engineering was done. And I read this really great anecdote that because a lot of the reconnaissance was done in the infrared, when they were bored in downtime, they would sometimes construct weird shapes on the exposed runways and then put heat sources, like build, you know, like heaters or like run machines really hot so that, you know, Soviet like flyovers would be like, what's that? Which I think is really funny.
Yeah, I've heard it's because there's a particular kind of high resolution photograph that's taken every time at the exact same time, or every day at the exact same time. So you can actually, if you get a notification from the satellite company that the satellite is going to take a picture in a particular place at a particular time, you can like all line up or spell something. I've heard of that being done before. Most of the time, people behave, but sometimes they don't.
So what do you think of some of the small satellite companies that are out there now, some of the efforts to, take additional surveillance of the planet and study it that way? Does that have any overlap with your work, or do you use that data?
So there's always a trade-off in the work that I do. So it's resolution versus the temporal nature of the imagery. So first of all, it's not just like I can get a satellite image, a high resolution image of a place like Egypt or Iceland or India, wherever we're looking, and the image is going to work. Satellite imagery works very differently in different times of the year because of things like weather. Wet season versus dry season. I've had the whole outlines of entire archaeological sites show up in January and then in August. I can throw the entire remote sensing kitchen sink at the site and I can't see a thing. And it's all because of the weather and the way the ground acts in relationship to groundwater moisture. So, and then, of course, when I'm mapping things like archaeological site looting, if I'm looking for progression of looting over time, then the temporal nature, which you get from these small CubeSats, becomes much more important because I'm looking for, is the site being looted over a course of weeks or months? And the high resolution imagery may image the site better, but I may not see the progression of looting. So for us, we'll use any and all data that we can. The great thing about a lot of these small CubeSat companies is that the imagery for us is free. The CEOs, the people that run the companies, are super collaborative and they want their data to be used. And the idea that we can use it anywhere in the world, there's tons of data available, is useful. But of course, there are trade-offs with privacy. You know, I joke with my students that it won't be too long from now and they're going to have to shut their shades because satellites can see through windows. And what happens when the resolution is good enough so that we can begin picking out individual people? What does that do to us? What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, this is a huge question. You know, the funny thing about astronomy is that astronomers, because we're constantly looking out, and you know, a lot of our decisions about like projects that we undertake, or you know, like science questions we decide to pursue, for many, like historically, have not really impacted people's lives directly that often. So, you know, like we're not working, for example, on human subjects where there's a whole lot of ethical training that goes into it. However, one of the things, and I think that this is true in your field as well, is that as image processing, this like, you know, ability to look at images with computer algorithms and maybe draw out things that you wouldn't have been able to by eye has become more and more important in astronomy. A lot of us work on algorithms called like machine learning algorithms, which are essentially advanced programs that can draw out information from data, whether it's images or whether it's other kinds of astronomical data. And, you know, draw out trends, you know, be able to do recognition of like galaxies in an automated way that are very closely related to things like facial recognition, you know, the ability to surveil things from space and then, or space or aircraft, and that those algorithms that we develop and perfect on images that don't impact human lives are often then portable out into arenas where they might be. And so there's a big movement, at least in my field, for astronomers to engage with data ethics and with the ethics of developing these tools much more directly, especially because, you know, like there's just not that many jobs in astronomy. So a lot of students, like graduate students that used to learn, that learn these kinds of techniques, then actually end up back out in industry where you hope that before that they get there, they've thought about some of the ethical implications of the things that they do.
Right. Yeah. And certainly in archaeology as well. So we're, as we're redeveloping the platform for India, you know, one of the big, I don't say complaints, because you know we're learning too with our Global Explorer platform, but one of the big sort of repetitive comments that we got was, we just look at a lot of images and we don't find anything. It's like, welcome to my world. This is science. I wish it were more exciting, but it, you know, it's the way it works. But the idea being, you know, we can use machine learning and we can train the machine to get rid of, say, the bad imagery, so the cloud cover, the dense urban areas, the areas where there's dense vegetation, areas where there are large blank fields, and then training the machine with hundreds and hundreds of known archaeological site types, the machine can then prioritize the imagery. So then the crowd is then saying to the machine, hey, these are actually things, and then we confirm them and the machine gets better and better. But what happens when the machine gets really, really good at doing this and our crowd has trained them? Have we just invented Skynet? And I keep expecting the Terminator to show up and like destroy my computer. And anyway, this is what happens when you let your imagination run away, working under fluorescent light for hours and hours. But I think about these things all the time, and our colleagues talk about them, like what's the trade-off? What are we doing? Is this really the right way to be doing science?
Yeah, well, and the thing that I often come back to is that even if the work that I am doing doesn't directly impact people, the fact that, you know, working at the Adler, like a big part of what I do is communicating about science, right? And the fact that I use some of those algorithms that are just, you know, out of the box stuff that, you know, are like little play toys compared to Skynet, maybe. But the fact that I use those and understand how they work and what they're capable of means when, you know, we see this stuff deployed on social media, for example, like I don't know if people saw that there's a huge, well, there probably will be shortly a huge class action lawsuit against Facebook for using facial recognition that's in the state of Illinois, that they just lost a case where they were arguing that individuals would have to press charges for use of facial recognition on their images, which is how Facebook and other sites like that tag you or your friends. So every time you hit yes, that's me, you're helping them get better at that. Anytime you, for example, did anyone use the make my face look older thing? Okay, good. Neither did I. If you did and you don't want to raise your hand, that's okay too.
I tricked it. I did a picture of myself and then I used an Egyptian mummy. I'm evil and subversive in ways that I know how to be.
It's like, take that, training set. Yeah. Yeah, so anytime, you know, like these things seem like super fun and it's like, oh, what would I look like, you know, in 100 years from now, an Egyptian mummy. But all of those are essentially helping companies or developers, whoever it happens to be who you're giving your image to, train those algorithms to do whatever. You don't know. That's kind of the problem. You don't actually know.
And I make sure whenever I'm teaching my introductory remote sensing class in the fall, and it's really important to me to do a whole class on ethics. So what happens when, say, I don't know, there's a really contentious divorce case, and high-resolution satellite imagery shows that a car with the exact same make and model and color of one partner is parked out in front of the address that happens to be the address of someone with whom you think your partner is having an affair with, and then there's proof. Is that coincidence? And how can this be used in bad ways as well? And we're getting that the imagery is getting better and better and better. And so, you know, we're not that far off from space-based individual recognition. And what happens when that happens? I don't know. I don't have the answers because there's equal light and darkness.
What should we talk about now? I know you wanted to talk a little bit about kind of history and this movement to maybe right some of both of our practices, historical wrongs. I know your book talks a bit about like the history of looting, and you know, I think it's interesting to hear about the work that you've done to right some of those wrongs in the present day, and also archaeology's participation in what was essentially looting, historically speaking.
Yeah, I think, I tell people we always have to acknowledge, you know, really complex and uncomfortable things about our field. And archaeology and anthropology obviously has pretty serious colonialist and racist backgrounds and histories. And this new generation of scientists and scholars, we're beginning to unravel and unpack and talk about how do we create more justice and more equity and more diversity in the fields. And I'm very sensitive to these issues as a white woman living in the U.S. So I try to make as much space as possible for especially my Egyptian colleagues and collaborators. Something that's been very important to us as we've gone into India. Because of course there's a pretty serious colonialist history there. We recognize that we're a company based in the U.S. and we do archaeological work, and the last thing we wanted to do was go in and tell our colleagues at the Archaeological Survey of India what they should be doing. That is not okay on so many levels. So instead, before we even made the decision to go there, I had a number of meetings with colleagues, and I said, hey, you know, this is what we do. Here's the menu. What interests you? What are your needs? What are your priorities? What would you even be interested in the possibility of a collaboration? And they were very excited, and they said, we want capacity building. We need large-scale countrywide mapping because we need to do risk assessments, and we want you to engage with the younger generation of archaeologists to provide them this training. So that's what we're doing. We're collaborating within Indian developers, and we're specifically providing needs for them. So we're trying. It's going to take time, but I think in talking about new ways of thinking, and I think these are much better ways of thinking, hopefully the dialogue will change. It's just going to take a lot of time.
Yeah, I think, and this is something that has come up in our field as well, you know, the history of astronomy, we're often talking about like, we've gone out and explored and discovered, and there's a lot of washing over the fact that a lot of those sort of what we would call early missions, so voyages out to various parts of the world to do observations, for example, of like the transit of Venus historically, were really not just about scientific exploration. They were about, you know, resource acquisition and scientists catching rides on voyages whose missions were ultimately colonialist. And we're seeing the legacy of that right now with some of the controversy over the construction of a new telescope called the TMT on Mauna Kea, which some of you might have seen in the news, that, you know, historically this is one piece in a much larger history of Hawaiian resistance, Native Hawaiian resistance in the state of what is now the state of Hawaii, but was once the Kingdom of Hawaii. And, you know, there's what I would say is a pretty significant rift in the field between astronomers who kind of want to do business as usual and want to say, well, you know, it's okay because we've created an education program for you, and it's not really in the spirit of what you're talking about, which is what does the community actually want and need? And sometimes the answer is we want our mountain back, and, you know, as astronomers, we kind of have to learn to be okay with that, because we've gotten what we wanted for a very long time over other people's wishes. But it's a really pretty heated debate going on for us as well.
And I think we're seeing these debates and discussions definitely bleed into very mainstream pop culture. So how many people here saw Black Panther? A lot of you. There's that iconic scene where the Killmonger is in front of, you know, the case of objects that were stolen from Wakanda. And, like, welcome to every museum that's in Europe or the U.S. They're full of stolen objects. And, yes, some of them were acquired legally, but that doesn't mean they were acquired ethically. There's a big difference. Because they were given under colonialist time periods, I think we have to ask a lot of really difficult and uncomfortable questions. I think we need to be listening a lot more to the indigenous peoples whose objects were taken. And now we're seeing this push to repatriate. We're seeing this push to give back. There have been a lot of discussions now as well in relationship to the Sacklers. And of course, they've profited and they've made a lot of money off the opioid epidemic, and yet they've funded so many museums. And now a couple museums in London have removed their name. So I think we have a lot of deconstructing to do of heritage and who owns the past and who has the right to display and take and share and show. And I think we're going to have a lot more talking to do before we begin to unravel the mess.
And a lot more listening.
Mostly listening.
Well, folks, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for tonight. I'd just like to thank our friends at the Adler Planetarium for co-presenting the program here tonight. And I'd like to thank both of you for such a wonderful evening of discussion.
Thank you
for having us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, Pulitzer Prize winner Deborah Blum discusses her book, The Poison Squad. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.